I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about what the Maine Center for Disease Control, which is the Maine State Public Health Department, has learned over the last couple of years. And because we don't have a lot of time to talk about... All right. Is that better? No? Yes?
No.
Okay. I'll do my best. This is where my voice starts to crack. So I've always been told nobody can hear me in the back of the room, so I apologize. But so we're talking a little bit about what we've learned at the Maine CDC for the last 2 years, and we have about 20 minutes to do it, which means you're getting the quick and dirty version, and we're going to kind of dive right into the weeds pretty quickly here. First of all, there's a disclaimer. I have nothing to disclose. And I want to share with you a few acknowledgments, because even though I'm standing here sharing this with you, it's really a group of people, of about 100 people, who have put time and effort into this to make it successful, including members of the Maine CDC and the Public Health Performance Improvement Team, which is my team there. We're going to talk a little bit about the background. I'm going to give you a couple of tools and techniques that we've found are particularly successful that are related to project management tools that apply very well to QI. I'm going to give you an example and then defer to questions till later. So the National Public Health Improvement Initiative came about from the Affordable Care Act in 2010. It was basically money that was provided to OSTILT, CDC OSTILT, and was awarded to 76 state, tribal, local, and territorial health departments. And the purpose was to systematically increase the performance management capacity of public health departments and increase the capacity and ability of health departments to meet national public health standards. For those of you who are not familiar with it, the Public Health Accreditation Board created a framework for accreditation to recognize state health departments for the work that they do and for meeting those standards, and it's very closely tied to the central public health services. My role in this whole thing is as the performance improvement manager. So with each public health department, there was an assigned performance improvement manager who is to represent the state or local health department. And so I'm one of 76. We get together once a year. And our role is really to create a culture of continuous quality improvement within the organization, creating a sustainable model, training people, implementing quality improvement and process improvement projects. One of the things that we did as an organization is we teamed up with the Public Health Foundation right at the beginning and said, well, what's the right model we should be using? And they introduced us to a variety of tools and methods, and we adopted the PDCA method. And I think probably this looks familiar to many of you, but it's a very simple, flexible model. There's Lean, there's Six Sigma, there's Lean Six Sigma. This one we like because it's so flexible, it's simple. Anybody can jump right in. And so we spent a couple of months introducing and training folks on this particular model, and then everybody got together and created QI projects based on this model. So just to give you a quick overview of what it is, the plan stage is really an approach where you sit as a team, you get together, you examine the problem, you do things like a root cause analysis, prioritization matrix, also you can do brainstorming, solution fault tree, we did a lot of those, and you analyze the problem, you decide what the right approach and the solution might be, and then you implement it, which is the do stage. As you're doing this, you're collecting improvement data. So at the end of that, you check the data, you compare it against the original data to see if there's an improvement or a change, and then you decide whether you're going to adopt, abandon, or act on it. So during this process, we made a fair number of, there were a fair number of learning opportunities, and basically what we found was that there were other skills and tools that we should be using in order to have a successful QI project, and those evolved around project management. And so we started looking closely at project management tools and methods and how we could incorporate those and just sort of build them into the QI project. So we had QI tools that we were using, but without facilitation, which was another key piece, and project management tools, the QI projects often fell flat. So we've done about 12 12 to 15 QI projects, depends if you want to say, you know, only count the ones that are finished at this point. We've done about 12 to 15 QI projects using the PDCA method. And then when we started formally incorporating the project management methods, which, as you'll notice, there's a lot of similarity because you have initiation, planning, execution, and closure, four components to it. You've got organizing the work. And this is sort of activities that go around the whole process, monitoring and controlling, project review, and project definition. If you look at that compared to the PDCA model, you'll see it, they're almost identical. And I was a project manager for several years before I worked for the university and worked with the Maine PDC on this. And it was funny, I was actually implementing a lot of project management tools into the work without even recognizing that they were separate from the QI process. Mm-hmm. So, you know, basically there's a huge amount of overlap for both project management and QI. And there are many common processes, and I've identified a couple here, such as identifying the team. A successful QI project will not succeed without the right team members and the right support. Determining the desired outcome, having a clear goal, clear objectives, and the data collection, that's a huge piece. A lot of the QI projects that we started with were, we think, very successful, but because the data wasn't there to measure and compare against, there's no way of actually validating that to people who want the numbers. And then establishing scope, budget, and timeline. But there are complementary tools too: data checklists, control charts, key performance indicators. I'm going to talk about the last three, the project plan, the Gantt chart, and the work packages, because I found that those were the key components that all of these really benefited from the most. And there are tons of other tools that you can use, such as checklists. We use checklists all the time, but there's no specific model or approach that we recommend for checklists. It's really dependent on the QI project. So this is a sample project plan. You can get them online. I particularly like this one because it also includes a lot of the information that you would use in a project charter, which is another QI tool. And it gives you the goal, which is key, the objective, the scope, and the boundary. And then also I find that it's very important to have a timetable and milestones. And then during the project, what we do is we, at key milestones, we'll regroup and meet, and people will report back in. So it creates a certain amount of accountability. The other great thing about the project plan is that it allows people to be on the same page. Everybody's in agreement. And if you're not in agreement, you know who isn't, you know where they stand, and you agree to move forward. So it gets a word out, and it's a great communication tool. Another technique is the work package breakdown. So once you create the project plan, you have certain activities that need to be done, and certain categories of activities that need to be done in order for the project to finish successfully. So it looks just like what it is. It's a decision tree and org chart. You identify the categories. It could be budget, it could be IT. Could be a specific program. And then within that, you identify not the people at this point, but just what needs to be done in order to meet that goal within that category. And then the third one I wanted to share with you, which may be familiar to many of you, is the Gantt chart. This takes and puts everything all together. So you know that, say, work package A takes a certain amount of time, and that work package B cannot be completed or started until work package A is done. So those are the critical path work packages. Then you also have the parallel paths showing float time, which basically means that, you know, it might need 2 weeks to take 2 weeks to complete, but you have a month in there of other activities that are going on before it becomes critical that it needs to be complete. So you can put that down there as well. It's another great communication tool because if someone is interested in seeing what you're doing and what the timeline is, it's clearly written here, you know, what the activity is. You usually know, you identify, it's not shown here, but who's working on that, who the accountable person or the responsible person. And you can share it with anybody in the organization, and it's a pretty quick and dirty way to show them what's going on and if you're on schedule. And again, also those milestones. When you're regrouping as a team and you want to talk about those milestones and where you are, and how far you've come, or if something's behind, this is a good tool to use as a talking point, speaking mechanism, so that you can actually say, okay, well, we're behind 2 weeks on this. What is that going to impact down the line? So I wanted to share with you one example that we're using. This project is actually still ongoing. But we had data that indicated that we were missing a lot of the secondary asylees and refugees in the Portland area, in Portland, Maine. And it's a fairly small town by San Francisco standards, but still it was enough to warrant a review and a potential quality improvement project. So we gathered the data, and we basically said, okay, the rationale for the project is this. The data supports that access to timely referrals for initial health assessment and establishing a need to increase primary medical homes for secondary refugees and asylum seekers in Portland is warranted. So we put together the aim after looking at the data, the objective, and then the scope and boundaries. And this is sort of the beginning and end point. And the reason scope and boundaries were important for us was because there's a lot of stuff that happens beforehand, before we get involved in the project, and after we decided that the project, this piece, this aspect of the process should end. And those can have a tendency to creep into discussions. Oh, we just found out this new information. We need to bring this up. We need to be doing that. We need to look at this. And if you don't define the scope and agree on the scope at the beginning, you end up having scope creep, and then the project gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and sometimes more expensive and longer, and then you'll see that it never ends. So what we do to address that is we put the scope and the boundaries in the project plan, and then at some point, if it warrants it, at the end of that project, we'll go back and we'll look at the beginning and at the end and see if there's another project in there that we need to be addressing. So this is just an example. I couldn't fit the whole thing on there, but this is just an example of the first half of the project plan. After that, we broke down the work into the work packages. So just to give you an example, I couldn't fit everything on here, but just to give you an example, data was a big one. So the very first thing we did was gather the existing baseline data. We found that it was almost complete, but we needed a little bit more. We found that out from analyzing and prioritizing the data issues. Then we identified and gathered new improvement data, ran the data results for comparison analysis, and then there's about 25 other work packages beyond this. So this thing can actually get quite big. And then for communication, that was another work package. And that was critical because we were working with internal partners and external partners. So we wanted to make sure that we were comprehensively including everybody either through email or making sure that if we had specific meetings, we're including them as well. And not inviting people to meetings that they weren't needed at, but still keeping them in the loop. And then lastly is the Gantt chart. And this just shows you the very beginning of the project right now. We're working on, the project's scheduled to end with a final report December 29th. So we're actually pretty much on schedule. But here you'll see the first thing that we did was we met with the patient coordinator at the Portland Community Health Center. We mapped the current process with him. We gathered the existing baseline data, and it kind of goes down from there. And the other thing is the week of 8-6, we were on schedule. But by 8:27, we were already off schedule. This reflected that. It also indicated that we needed to get certain people together to meet and have a conversation about what we were going to do to fix that. And so we did, and it brought everything back on schedule by 9:10. So these are just three examples, three tools that you can use applying project management tools to QI projects. I think that based on my experience and based on my team's experience, without using the combination of the tools, it doesn't really work. You run into problems. You can make it work. It's just a little bit tricky. So they are complementary approaches. What we found by including both of them is that there is improved accountability, improved communications. People are happier with more communications. People say, oh, we don't want to be over-communicated to. But if you have to err on one side or the other, always over-communicate, especially in a project. There's a better understanding of each person's roles and contributions, so you know where your role begins and where it ends, and then you know who the next person is to hand off to. So if you're running into problems, but you know it's not a team meeting, doesn't warrant a team meeting, but you might want to contact the other person, you know who to call, and that's because you're using these tools. Aligned expectations, commitment throughout the project. One of the biggest challenges we have is that we have a lot of people with competing interests, and I think most health departments, doesn't matter what health department, but are usually stretched to the max and usually don't have enough staff to do everything. So this helps align the commitment and the people's expectations, and if there's an issue right up front, if someone has something that comes up, they can bring it to their supervisor or manager and show them what you've been working on. They understand immediately what's going on, and they can give that person either the support they need or find someone else who can, so your project doesn't suffer. And that's not always the case. I can tell you right now, we lost a key IT staff person. He moved. There was nobody else with that skill in the organization, so the whole project was delayed for about 6.5 months until we've been with someone. We had to replace that. So there are circumstances where this is not a way it doesn't work. But for the most part, this is proven to be quite successful. And it does increase the likelihood of finishing on time. The only thing that I might add here is that in the state of Maine, we have project managers assigned to every project. So even though it might not be someone who is a project manager, it is someone who is responsible for making sure the project finishes all the way to the end and understands what that role means and the time commitment. And if you have any questions, that's my contact information. And then I have some resources as well.